I'd like you to turn to the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 2, please. Daniel chapter 2. We're going to look at a scripture here in the book of Daniel. And this is the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, and he was perplexed about what it meant. He probably didn't remember what it was, according to what the Bible says, and he wanted Daniel to not only tell him what the dream was, but also to interpret the dream. And we're going to begin to read here in verse 32. He said, the images, this is Daniel describing the image. He said, the image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, and its feet of iron, its feet partly of iron, legs of iron, excuse me, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. So we have this image, and the head of the image was gold. It was a golden head. The interpretation is given right here in the same chapter. Notice verse 36. This is the dream. I just finished giving you the dream, O Nebuchadnezzar. Now I'm going to tell you what his interpretation is. Verse 37. You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the air, he has given them into your hand, and he has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. So when we look at this image, we understand that the Babylonian system is the head of gold. We understand that King Nebuchadnezzar was a king of Babylon. After him came the Medes and the Persians, the two arms, the Greeks with the midsection of brass, and then the Roman Empire, Eastern and Western division with the two legs made of iron, and then the coming United States of Europe. But the point is this, Babylon, or Nebuchadnezzar, was the head of gold. The Babylonian kingdom was the head of gold. Now, interesting thing about this image is that this image is not cut down until Jesus Christ returns. So even though the Babylonian kingdom doesn't exist anymore, it's still alive and well. Now you may ask, how is that possible? Well, I want you to consider maybe just a few things. How about the holidays that this world keeps? They keep holidays that are founded on Babylonian principles. One of them is the holiday of Christmas. Christmas is a time of gift giving, of joy, of honoring Christ. How many of us have not heard the statement, you know, Jesus is a reason for the season? That type of thing. You see that on bumper stickers all everywhere. On December the 25th, the world stops to pay homage to this world's religion. What religion? The Christian religion? No, the Babylonian religion. The head controls the body. The head controls the body. The head tells the arms what to do, tells the legs what to do. If you examine world history, you'll see that all of the kingdoms that came after the Babylonian kingdom took some of their attributes from Babylon. And that includes the world's holidays. So this world system is based on what empire? On many, but most of it is based on the Babylonian system. So today what we're going to do is we're going to look at Christmas and its origins. We're also going to see what the implication of this information is for all of us. Because, you know, the Bible has a lot of information, but we need to apply it to ourselves. So what we're going to do today in this sermon is we're going to look at Christmas, where it came from, and what that means for each and every one of us today. Now, the first thing we need to consider is what does the Bible say and what does God say about how we should worship him? Some people say it really doesn't matter how you worship as long as you have a good heart. Some say it really doesn't matter how you worship him as long as Christ is in the center of everything. It really doesn't matter how you worship him as long as your intentions are good. Is this true? Well, let's go back to Deuteronomy and let's look at the instructions that God gave the children of Israel when they came into the promised land. Deuteronomy chapter 12. Now we had the children of Israel coming out of Egypt. They had been in slavery for hundreds of years. They were going to be going into a land that was already populated. The population of the land was going to be removed or killed off by war. And God gave the children of Israel instructions as to what they were supposed to do when they came into this land. We're going to look at Deuteronomy chapter 12, and we're going to read in verse 29. And consider about intentions and about Christ being in the center of everything, and about it doesn't matter as long as your heart is right. Consider those subjects when we read these verses. So we're looking at Deuteronomy 12, verse 29. When the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess, and you displace them and dwell in their land, take heed to yourself, be careful, that you are not ensnared to follow them. You ever considered what a snare is? A snare is a trap. Now, if you're going to step on the trap, you don't know it's there. Because if you knew the trap was there, there's a trap there, I'm going to go around it. A snare means something that takes you by surprise. It ensnares you. Take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their God, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? I also will do likewise. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. For every abomination to the Lord, which he hates, they have done: child sacrifice, murder, sexual perversion, sodomy, all of those sins, idolatry, Sabbath breaking. For every abomination to the Lord which he hates, they have done to their gods. For they burn even their sons and their daughters in the fire to their gods. Whatever I command you, be careful to observe it, and you shall not add to it, nor take away from it. Now, if you want to read what God commands us to do, there's a couple of places you can do that. I'm not going to do that in this sermon, but one is the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20. If you want to know what days he expects us to observe, you can go to Leviticus 23. And you find nothing in those chapters and those scriptures and those verses, anything about Christmas or about Easter or about any of the other world's popular holidays. Notice the first couple of verses in this same chapter, Deuteronomy chapter 12 and in verse 1. These are the statutes and the judgments which you shall be careful to observe in the land which the Lord God of your fathers is giving you to possess all the days that you live on the earth. You shall adopt their systems. Is that what it says? You shall utterly destroy all the places where the inhabitants which you shall dispossess served their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills on and under every green tree. You shall destroy their altars, break down their sacred pillars. And I don't want to be vulgar here, brethren, but when you study what the sacred pillars were, it's very, very interesting what they were. Some things I cannot mention in services. And burn their wooden images with fire. You shall cut down the carved images of their gods and destroy their names from that place. You shall not worship the Lord your God with such things, but you shall seek the place where the Lord your God chooses out of all your tribes to put his name for his dwelling place, and there you shall go. Talking prophetically about their time is coming when I am going to build a temple. Now they had a tabernacle that had wandered around with them in the wilderness, and it was a temporary tent where they worshiped. That was placed at Shiloh when they came into the land, the promised land. And then later on, that was replaced by the temple. So God is saying, don't worship these people. Don't adopt their systems. Don't adopt their idols. Don't ask how their gods were worshiped. I'm going to put my worship center, and it's going to be obvious where you should worship and how you should worship. So this is what God was telling the people. Don't try to find out how they did things and copy them. Don't do that. Exodus 32. This is a very interesting example here. Exodus 32. Now, you remember the story about the children of Israel came out of Egypt. They had been in Egypt for several hundreds of years. They came out of Egypt, and Moses goes up to commune with God. He goes up into the mountain. And he's there for quite a long time. Eventually, he was there for 40 days. And he went back again for 40 more days. But he was there for a long, long time. And so while he's gone, the children of Israel are camped there in the wilderness at the base of the mountain. The children of Israel, where is Moses? What has happened to Moses? Maybe he's fallen into a ravine. Maybe he's fallen off of the mountain. Maybe some wild animal has gotten him. You know, he's an older man. Maybe he had a heart attack up there. Maybe he's dead. I mean, how long are we going to wait for Moses? Where is this Moses? Now, notice Exodus chapter 32. Now, when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron, his older brother, and said to him, "Come, make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. I mean, he might be up there dead. So what we want you to do is you're going to make us a god, Aaron. You're going to make us some gods. Because I think the jig with Moses is up. I think it's over. Fine. Complete. No more. It's gone. We don't know where Moses is." And Aaron said to them, "Oh, no, no, no. Please don't do this. This is we don't need to make gods. Have faith and all of that." No. Aaron says, "You know, break off your golden earrings, which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. So bring me all this gold." So all the people broke off the golden earrings, which were in their ears, and brought them to Aaron. Now, one of the principal gods of the Egyptians was the calf, or the cow, or the bull. Matter of fact, you can go to some places in India today, and they still worship cattle. And if you look at the plagues that God sent on Egypt, one of the plagues was on the cattle. They had a murrain. They had a disease. They died. And also he killed some of the cattle with the hail and all that. He actually was pronouncing judgment on the gods of Egypt. So one of the things he did was he destroyed all the cattle because the people worshiped the cattle. And obviously if you have something that destroys the cattle, then the cattle aren't gods. And that's what Moses did and God did through the plagues. Bull god later became incorporated into Mithra worship, which was adopted by the Romans. Same system, different name. But notice what he says here in verse 4. "And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool, and he made a molten," or a molten, because he melted it and then molded it, "a molten calf. Then they said, 'This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt.'" So they make this golden calf. Now you can't get any more biblical than Aaron. You can't get any more biblical than the children of Israel coming out of Egypt. I mean, they had seen all the miracles of God. They had heard the Ten Commandments being thundered off of the mountain. I mean, we often say, you know, man, if I only lived the time of the people of the Bible, of the book, I would be different. I would be different. So they make this god, this calf, and they begin to say that this is the God that brought us out of Egypt, O Israel. My point is this, notice verse 5. "So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, 'Tomorrow is a feast to the God of the Mithra bull god?' No, he said, 'Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord.'" What we're going to do is we're going to take this God and we're going to attribute it to the God of the Bible. So we're going to take this bull god and it's actually going to be a feast to the real God. But we're going to use this bull god as our focus worship. Yeah, does that sound familiar? That's exactly what has always been done with idolatry. If you study the Catholic writings and you go to the Catholic dictionaries and the Catholic encyclopedias and the Catholic websites, they will tell you, oh yes, we use images and pictures. But those are not idols because we use those to help focus our worship on the God that's above. So they manipulate the plain teachings of the scriptures to do what they want to do. And the Bible says, do not add to it, do not subtract from it. And here we have a festival to God. They had mixed paganism with the true worship and come up with a hybrid. And what did God say about doing that in Deuteronomy? He said, don't do that. Don't mix me up with what's going on in the world. Let's go to Judges. Judges. Children of Israel come out of Egypt, go into the promised land. Joshua is their ruler after Moses dies. He brings them into the promised land, settles them, and gives them their divisions. And the Bible says that all the children of Israel during the time of Joshua were obedient to God. And during the time of the lifespan of the elders that knew Joshua, they were loyal to God. But after the elders that were alive, when Joshua was alive, and after Joshua died, and that line of elders died, we have then the book of Judges being written about what was going on. Notice Judges chapter 17. Judges chapter 17. In verse 1. Now there was a man from the mountains of Ephraim whose name was Micah. And he said to his mother, "The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you and on which you put a curse, even saying it in my ears, here is the silver with me." In other words, his mother had some silver. Micah had taken the silver, and his mother had pronounced a curse on whoever had taken it. So Micah says, "Here's your silver back." And verse 2, "I took it," last part, "and his mother said, 'May you be blessed by the Lord, my son.' So when he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, 'I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son.'" He's dedicated it to God, the Lord. But how is he going to dedicate it? "I'm going to make a carved image and a molded image. Now, therefore, I will return it to you." So he said, "Well, my son, I really intended this to be for you. And what I was going to do is I was going to make an image of it, a god to the Lord. And I was going to give it to you. So I'm going to return it to you." Verse 4. "Thus he returned the silver to his mother. Then his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave it to the silversmith, and he made it into a carved image and a molded image, and they were in the house of Micah." You notice how many times the word Lord is mentioned in here? That's a true God. They're mentioning Lord with making idols and silver and the silversmith and all of that. Same scenario, let's go to verse 10. "Micah said to him, 'Dwell with me, and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes, and your sustenance.' So the Levite went in." This was Micah. "Then the Levite was content to dwell with a man, and the young man became like one of his sons to him." So Micah, who hired this Levite, itinerant preacher, hired him to be the priest over his house from the tribe of Levi. Verse 12, "So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, 'Now I know that the Lord will be good to me, since I have a Levite as a priest.'" And you know what their worship center was? The image that Micah had made, that his mother had made for him. They set that up. They hired a Levite priest. He paid him so much money, gave him so much changes of clothes, and we're going to have a worship center, and we're going to worship this idol. But it's to the Lord. It's to the Lord. And this is right here an example of taking what is godly and mixing it with what is pagan and thinking you have something that's going to please God. You can read, it's very interesting when you read the whole chapter about what happened. Then later on about what happened when the Danites approached him. About, would you rather be a priest to one man or would you rather be a priest to the whole tribe? So all the Danites hired this priest that Micah had hired. Hired him away from Micah. And the priest stole the idols and took them to the tribe of Dan that were to become their gods. So it even, you know, the plot thickens, so to speak. So it even got worse than it did. So idols to the Lord are mentioned. So what I'm getting at is just because something claims to be centered on God, or something is to be done for God, or something is given the name of God, doesn't mean it's God's. It doesn't mean it's God's. Now, another thing that we have to remember when we look at Christmas, we have to consider what God says about how we should worship him. We also need to consider that the current Christmas worship is centered, much of it, on astrology. Astrology. And astrology is forbidden. You know, and I'll show you that in a minute, but as far as it being centered on astrology. But first of all, we got to look at, is astrology forbidden? And the answer is very obvious. Let's go to Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 47. Isaiah 47. Isaiah 47. Notice verse 13. You are wearied in the multitude of your counselors. Let now the astrologers, the stargazers, and the monthly prognosticators stand up and save you from what shall come upon you. There was a time of trouble coming upon the people of God through the hand of Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar. And God says here that the astrologers, the counselors, the stargazers, those that made monthly predictions, I mean, if you want to know the current term for monthly prognosticators, you can go into your newspaper every day and you can read what the astrological forecasts are for that day, for the next week, and for the coming month for you. So people make forecasts, monthly forecasts. So this is talking about astrologers and astrology. It was forbidden. They were not to, you were not to concern yourself with them. In other words, he's saying there's a time of trouble coming. You've been leaning on these astrologers and all these forecasters, stellar forecasters. Let them save you out of this time of trouble that's coming. Let them pronounce what's going to come to pass upon you now. He was being a little sarcastic, but that's what he was saying. So astrology is forbidden. Jeremiah chapter 10. Jeremiah chapter 10. I got to show you that astrology is forbidden and decried in the scriptures, because if I can show you that Christmas is based on astrology, then obviously you shouldn't be observing it. Jeremiah chapter 10. And verse 1. It says, hear the words which the Lord speaks to you, O house of Israel. Thus says the Lord, do not learn the way of the Gentiles. Some scriptures or some translations say the way of the heathen. Do not be dismayed at the sign of heaven. For the Gentiles are dismayed at them. For the customs of the people are futile. For one cuts a tree from the forest, the work of the hands of the workman with an axe. They decorate it with silver and gold. Sound familiar? They fasten it with nails and hammers so it will not topple. They are upright like a palm tree, and they cannot speak. They must be carried because they cannot go by themselves. Do not be afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, nor can they do any good. A lot of people think that this sounds like a Christmas tree being described, and the reason is because it's being described, what's being described here is a Christmas tree. I mean, that's what's being described. And it says in verse 2, do not learn the way of the heathen. Taking a tree, cutting out of the forest, putting silver and gold and fastening down so it doesn't move is a way of the heathen. It's a way of the Gentile. It's a customs of the people. In verse 3, it's futile. We shouldn't be learning to do that. And notice that it's also based on verse 2. The way of the heathen or the Gentiles, do not be dismayed at the signs of the heavens. Because you see, Christmas is based on certain calendric events. Certain events out of the calendar, certain events that have to do with the stars and what goes on with the coming of the darkening winter days. So we should not be worried about all of that. Second Kings. And we're going to look in Second Kings. Verse 23, we're looking at astrology and forecasters from the heavens. 2 Kings chapter 23. And notice, this is, mine has a heading on it, Josiah restores the true worship. Verse 5, then he, Josiah, removed the idolatrous priest whom the kings of Judah had ordained to burn incense on the high places on the cities of Judah, and in the places all around Jerusalem, and those who burn incense to Baal, to the sun, to the moon, to the constellations, and to all the hosts of heaven. So there were a bunch of astrologers that were associated with the pagan element that had crept into the temple. And Josiah, and these people were on the payroll, and Josiah removed them. He removed them. Wherever you find the priest of Baal and false worship of God, you find people that are concerned with what the heavens say and what the stars say, and prognosticators of astrological events. That goes hand in hand. So astrology is forbidden. It is forbidden. Now, when my children are all growing up, none of them keep Christmas. When they were younger, I'm talking about 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, one of the common activities that we would do on the Sabbath, usually in the early part of December, is I would go to the store, and I would get about $4 or $5 worth of nickels and dimes, and I would give them a couple of dollars in nickels and dimes, and we would go to the library, a few blocks from our house. This is before the internet. And I would go to the library, and I'd say, there's a copy machine right there. It takes nickels and dimes. Make a copy for a nickel. I want you to find me all the articles you can on Christmas and make me copies, encyclopedias, magazines, whatever. I'm going to read you some of the things that they copied out, all right? This is out of Christmas. It's a book titled Christmas, Chapter 7. This is Chapter 7 entitled Christmas. This is Catholic Customs and Traditions, a Popular Guide. This was printed in 1993. It says, on the origins of Christmas, the primitive church seems to have had little or no interest in the actual date or circumstances of Jesus' birth. A higher priority was their expectation of an immediate consummation of history and a final coming of Christ. You know why? Because the early church believed that Christ was going to return and set up a kingdom. Here's continuing with the article. The actual date of Christ's birth is unknown. The Gospels do not record it, nor is there any early tradition to identify it. This is all Catholic writings. A date of Christmas in the same book. Rome had a nativity festival by 336, and probably a generation or so earlier. There is still disagreement among scholars concerning the reason why these early Christians of the late 3rd and 4th century chose to celebrate Jesus' birth on December the 25th. Theories still popular today are based on three tendencies of the early Christians: their high respect for symbolism, their natural tendency to borrow from the real world around them, and their attempts to offset the influence of pagan festivals. Early symbolism is very powerful at this time of year in the Northern Hemisphere. Remember, we're talking about predicting the seasons and astrologers and stargazers and all that. Early symbolism is very powerful at this time of the year in the Northern Hemisphere. Each year, Christians, along with the general population, notice that beginning with the fall equinox, the darkness of night begins creeping up on daylight as days become shorter and nights become longer. At the winter solstice, which is around December the 20th, this situation changes and the light of day began once again to defeat the darkness of night. The winter solstice occurred on December the 25th on the Julian calendar and became a popular date for Christmas. What was happening is the pagans saw the nights getting longer and the days getting shorter, and they thought there was some kind of things going on with their pagan gods. So we have to worship and supplicate the gods. And then because our supplications were accepted, then the nights became shorter and the days became longer. Because if it hadn't, we'd be plunged into total darkness. And the sun would lose its control over the physical world. And we know that the sun gives us our crops, and it heats us, and et cetera, et cetera. So we don't want the sun to go away. I'm going to still be reading out of this book. Mithraism, a pagan sun cult popular in the Roman Empire during primitive Christianity, promoted this natural symbolism. Devotees of Mithra, a Persian deity, celebrated the birthday of their sun god with a festival called Dies Natalis Solis Invicti, which is birthday of the unconquered sun, at the winter solstice. In 274, Emperor Aurelian proclaimed this sun god the principal divine patron of the Roman Empire. He promulgated the feast throughout the empire in an effort to promote unity by way of uniform religious monotheism. They were monotheistic. Mono means one, theistic means God. They had one God. The only problem was it was the wrong one. It was a sun god. There was a whole religion built on this called Mithra worship. And popular with a sun god, sometimes the sun god was displayed as a physical being it was displayed as a bull. Displayed as a bull. Let me keep reading here. This is an article one of my children copied. This sun cult or mystery religion became a threat to Christianity. The two religions shared some religious disciples, doctrine, and symbolisms in common, such as initiation, fasting, immersion, a meal of bread and wine, fellowship, and belief in the immortality of the soul. This is pagan Christianity and the true Christianity. One theory is that Christians began to celebrate the birth of Jesus on December the 25th, when this festival of the sun became popular in Rome. Christianity would have been comfortable with the symbolism because its own gospel speaks of light or sun, S-U-N, as a symbol for the presence and the meaning of Christ. This adoption of this date for the birthday of Jesus would have challenged people to turn from adoration of the material sun to adoration of Christ, the truly unconquered light of the world. You can see how paganism is being mixed with Christianity. With the promulgation of the Edict of Milan in 313, Constantine became the benefactor and the protector of Christianity. Consequently, pagan cultural features of sun symbolism were no longer threatening. You may put that in plain English. Because Constantine became the emperor and he worshiped the sun, everybody else started worshiping the sun. They could be freely absorbed by the church. The church, with its nativity date of December the 25th already in place, did precisely this. It promoted comparisons between the birth of Jesus and the winter solstice. Now, what did the book of Deuteronomy say we should not do? Let's take what we got and let's put it with what they've got and let's mix it together. Don't add to it. Don't subtract to it. This is still this book entitled Catholic Customs and Traditions, a Popular Guide. This is another section, Popularity of Christmas. During the Middle Ages, Christmas exploded in popularity. So did religious traditions associated with it. Christmas competed with a more important celebration of the Paschal mystery at Easter, and in popular practice began to outshine it. New peoples from the barbarian tribes of Europe took to the feast wholeheartedly. Duh. You would wonder why. They were already observing it in another fashion. They added elements from their own pre-Christian winter traditions, putting their stamp on Christmas traditions that continue today. Traditions such as the burning of the Yule log, the lighting, the evergreen tree, the mistletoe, and various things like that. In the 16th century, the Protestant Reformation in some countries challenged the excessive celebration of Christmas, since much of it was not at all connected directly with the mystery of Jesus' birth. Puritans in England, for example, condemned all celebrations of Christmas as pagan. After they came to political power, they outlawed through Parliament in 1643 any observance of Christmas along with Easter and All Saints' Days under pain of punishment. This Puritan attitude came to the American colonies in the 17th century. So there were a few voices shouting out that it was pagan, but most of the world accepted all of these holidays. This is another article. This is the Book of Knowledge Encyclopedia, published in 1992. This was entitled Christmas. Christians the world over celebrate December the 25th as Christmas. It is thought that December the 25th was chosen because it was around this time, around the time of various pagan festivals, such as the Roman Saturnalia. These festivals marked the winter solstice, the time of year when days began to grow longer in the northern hemisphere. Many Christmas customs are thought to have begun with practices associated with these pagan festivals. I mean, how much more plainer can you get, brethren? It's interesting when you study that Christmas wasn't formulated till around 300 or 400 years after Christ's death. So that means for about 300 years, there was no such thing as Christmas. If you would have asked Paul about Christmas, he wouldn't know what you were talking about. If you'd have asked Polycarp or Polycrates, what about Christmas? They would have known what you were talking about. Now, just to give you an idea, the United States came into being as a nation in 1777. Okay? That was about 300 years ago, about 350 years ago from today, came into being as a country. Christmas was not known for a period longer than that. in the Christian world. So in other words, for a time longer than we've been a nation, there was no such thing as Christmas. Christmas came into being around 325 to 400 AD. Now let me read you another article. This is out of the Zondervan Pictorial Bible Dictionary, published in 1967. It says, Christmas, the anniversary of the birth of Christ and its observance celebrated by most Protestants and by Roman Catholics on December the 25th. Whether the early Christians thought of or observed Christmas is not clear. Once introduced, the observance spread throughout Christendom. Some Christian bodies disapproved of the festival. Many customs of pagan origin have become part of Christmas. For example, Christmas tree. But most of these no longer have heathen connotations, but have acquired a Christian meaning. Example, the Christmas tree points towards upwards to God and reminds us of his gifts. Okay? You say so. This is another article in a book called Christmas Before Christmas. Kind of interesting title, published in 1990. There is actually no evidence that the historical Jesus was born in December. His birth was not celebrated until nearly 400 years after his death. And the term Christmas, Mass is a Catholic term. A Mass is a Catholic observance. So they had a Mass in honor of Christ. So they'll call it Christmas. And they shortened it to Christmas. So Christmas is a Catholic term. His birth was not celebrated then until nearly 400 years earlier, after his death, and the term Christmas wasn't used until the 11th century. So even when the Catholics were celebrating the Yule celebration, it wasn't known as Christmas. It was known as something else. It wasn't called Christmas till about 900 years ago. But long before the birth of Christ, the 25th of December was the date of the Roman winter solstice, the midpoint of a festive season that extended from the Saturnalia, which began on December the 17th, and was a festival of tribute to Saturn, the god of plenty, to the Calends in January. This was another god, the Calends, that's where we get the word calendar from, to the Calends in January, which marked the beginning of the new year. At the same time of the year, the Tetons in the north celebrated the festival of Yule, and the Mithraic religion of Persia, an early competitor of Christianity, celebrated the birth of the unconquered son. They all got married together, brother. Here's an article out of the Encyclopedia Britannica entitled Christmas. The reason why Christmas came to be celebrated on December the 25th remains uncertain. But most probably the reason is that early Christians wished the date to coincide with a pagan Roman festival marking the birthday of the unconquered sun. In other words, the sun's not going to be setting and never rising again. We want it to be unconquered, so we have a festival of the unconquered sun, which means the sun will start rising earlier and earlier, and pretty soon the days will be longer like they should be. Because if not, if every day is shorter by a few minutes and we have more darkness, then pretty soon the sun's not going to be shining anymore. And so we don't want the sun to be conquered. So we called it the Natalis Solis Invicti, or the birthday of the unconquered sun. This festival celebrated the winter solstice, when the days again began to lengthen and the sun began to climb higher in the sky. The traditional customs connected with Christmas have accordingly developed from several sources as a result of the coincidence of the celebration of the birth of Christ with the pagan agricultural and solar observances at midwinter. In the Roman world, the Saturnalia, December the 17th, was a time for merrymaking and exchanging of gifts. This occurred thousands of years, brethren, before Christ was even born. December the 25th was also regarded as the birth date of the Iranian, put in there Persian, Iranian mystery god Mirtha, the sun, S-U-N, of righteousness. On the Roman New Year, January the 1st, houses were decorated with greenery and lights, and gifts were given to the children and the poor. To these observances were added the German and Celtic Yule rites, food and good fellowship, the Yule log and Yule cakes, greenery and fir trees, gifts and greetings, all commemorated different aspects of this festive season. Fire and lights, symbol of warmth and lasting life, have always been associated with the winter festival, both pagan and Christian. Since the European Middle Ages, evergreens as symbols of survival have been associated with Christmas. So those are actually articles that my children have copied out of various books and articles when they were about 10 or 11 years old. And I'm sure you could go online on the internet today, just put in Christmas, paganism, you will get more information than you can read in several weeks. So Christmas is definitely pagan. It is definitely pagan.
I would suspect a large part of the Christmas tree probably came from the Wiccan traditions.
It did. And they considered it, the Druids worshipped the oak.
Yep.
They worshipped the oak because the oak was long-lasting and immortal and various other things.
It was evergreen.
Evergreen.
It always had life.
That's correct. So it was introduced by the Catholic Church to appease the pagans that were coming into the Catholic Church. Let's look at some interesting examples in the Bible. Let's look at what happened to ancient Israel as an example. Because what happened to ancient Israel has happened to Christianity. Let's look at 1 Kings. 1 Kings. You should be in 2 Kings. We're going to go back about 10 or 15 pages to 1 Kings. And we're going to look at chapter 11. And we're going to look at chapter 12. We're just going to skim these real quickly. But chapter 11 and chapter 12 are very interesting. You know, Solomon was blessed by God. He was given wisdom by God. He was given the kingdom of the children of Israel to rule over. The kingdom of Israel, or the children of Israel, are the nation he worshiped, he ruled over, were made up of the 12 tribes of Israel, Judah, Levi, and the other 10 tribes. They were all combined together. There was only one king at this time, and that was King David, his son. Remember Bathsheba and all that went on with him, Uriah the Hittite. Solomon was the second son born to Bathsheba. The first one died. God forgave David, said, "Your son Solomon, whose name is Peace, is going to build my temple. He's going to be a great king, and through him the dynasty is going to continue, and you'll never lack for a son to sit on the throne." So Solomon is the direct descendant of David, and he is now ruling over all of the 12 tribes. As you know, in chapter 11, first couple of verses, Solomon's heart is turned away by all the pagan women he marries. Notice verse 4, the middle part. His wives turned his heart after other gods, and his, Solomon's heart, was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. For Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Milcom, the abomination of the Amorites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not fully follow the Lord as did his father David. Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill that is east of Jerusalem, and from Molech. Molech was the one that the children of Israel offered up their children to and burnt sacrifices and burnt offerings. Child sacrifices were offered up to Molech. And he built an altar for him. Verse 8, and he did likewise for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to the gods. So the Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Verse 11, therefore the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I'm not going to do it till you're dead. And I'm not going to completely tear it away because I made promises to your father David. Now, in verse 26, then Solomon's servant Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, an Ephraimite from Zeredah, whose mother's name was Zeruah, a widow, also rebelled against the king. So we have Jeroboam, all right? The man Jeroboam, verse 28, was a mighty man of valor. He was apparently a go-getter. In verse 29, now it happened at that time, when Jeroboam went out from Jerusalem, that the prophet Ahijah, the Shilonite, met him on the way, and he clothed himself with a new garment, and the two of them were alone in the field. Then Ahijah took hold of the new garment that was on him, and tore it into 12 pieces. How many tribes were there? 12. And he said to Jeroboam, take for yourself 10 pieces. Now, you have to remember, the Levites did not have a place in the land that they were given when the land was divided up. Their place was Jerusalem, and they were the priests over the temple that had been built. So they were mainly centered in Jerusalem, where Solomon lived. And he said to Jeroboam in verse 31, take for yourself 10 pieces, for thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I will tear the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon, and I will give 10 pieces to you. But he shall have one tribe for the sake of my servant David, for the sake of Jerusalem. It's actually going to be two tribes, as you'll see later, Levite and part of the tribe of Benjamin, who lived nearby the city. Why? In verse 33, because they have forsaken me and worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the goddess of the Moabites, and Milcom, the god of the people of Ammon, have not walked in my ways to do what is right in my eyes and keep my statutes and my judgments as did his father. However, I will not take the whole kingdom out of his hand, because I have made him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of my servant David. So he's going to take part of it and give it, 10 tribes, and give it to Jeroboam. All right, verse 41. Now, verse 40, Solomon therefore sought to kill Jeroboam, so Jeroboam flees to Egypt. So Jeroboam, while Solomon is alive, is told that he is going to be given 10 of the tribes. Solomon's descendants are going to keep the other two because I have promises I made to David. And I'm not going to do it until Solomon dies. Solomon finds all this out, comes after Jeroboam to kill him for obvious reasons. Jeroboam flees to Egypt. While Jeroboam is in Egypt, Solomon dies. Verse 41. Now the rest of the acts of Solomon, all that he did in his wisdom, are they not written in the book of the acts of Solomon? Verse 43, then Solomon rested with his fathers and was buried in the city of David, his father, in Jerusalem, and Rehoboam, his son, reigned in this place. So we got Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, and Jeroboam, the servant of Solomon. Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, is given two tribes. Jeroboam, the servant of Solomon, is given 10 tribes. Now, in verse 12, or chapter 12, there's a revolt against Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. You remember the story? The people come and say, make our taxes lighter. He consults with the older man. He consults with the younger man. He takes the advice of the younger man. Says, you know what? You thought my dad was bad. I'm going to be worse. I'm going to tax you more. They rebel. 10 tribes leave in rebellion. This is all God's hand working to separate the kingdom from Rehoboam and Solomon. To make a long story short, Jeroboam comes out of exile and takes control of the 10 tribes that have revolted. Rehoboam goes to war against Jeroboam. Rehoboam, the two-tribe man, goes to war against Jeroboam, the 10-tribe man. And God says, don't do this. This is from me. So Jeroboam is the king over the tribes of Israel. And Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, is over the tribe of Judah and Levite and Benjamin, centered on Jerusalem. So now the children of Israel have been divided into two parts. The part that's controlled by Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, and the part that's controlled by Jeroboam, the servant of Solomon. Jeroboam, the servant of Solomon, has 10 of the tribes. Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, has 2 of the tribes and is living in Jerusalem, where the temple is. That's the story. All right, now, verse 18 of Jeroboam, of 1 Kings 12, verse 18. Then King Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, 2 tribes living in Jerusalem, sent the tax collector. And they stoned the tax collector. And so it was a rebellion. Verse 21, and when Rehoboam came to Jerusalem, he assembled all the house of Judah with the tribe of Benjamin. So there was Judah, Benjamin, and part of Levi to fight against the house of Israel. Now here's a very important thing, nothing to do with Christmas and all that, but something very interesting. The children of Israel are not one unified nation anymore. Historically, we have a king of Israel and we have a king of Judah. Before this time, we only had one king who was over the tribes of Israel. Now we have two kings. Sometimes it'll say the king over Israel. Sometimes it'll say the king over Judah. That's why, because they were divided at this time. Now, God intended to work through Jeroboam. All right? There's only one problem. Jeroboam did not remain faithful. He became wicked. Verse 25. Then Jeroboam built Shechem. This is the one that owned, that has the 10 tribes, the one that's outside of Jerusalem, the servant. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim and dwelt there. Also, he went out from there and built Peniel. And Jeroboam says to himself, he says, you know what? The holy days are coming up. And the holy days are coming up, and the holy days are observed in Jerusalem, where the priests are, where the Levites are. And all of Israel, as is normal, is going to go to Jerusalem to keep the feast days, the Feast of Tabernacles. And what's going to happen? They're going to go to Jerusalem. They're going to see their old relatives, their old friends. They're going to see the priest. They're going to get caught up in all of this worship of the Lord. And they're going to say to themselves, why do we need two kings? Let's get rid of Jeroboam and let's reunite with the house of Judah. We don't need two kings. After all, we're all related. Verse 26, and Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah. So I have to develop a plan that keeps this from happening. Verse 28. Therefore, the king asked advice, made two calves of gold. Who was the god of the Mithra Persian worship? Who was the god? The bull. The calf. What was the god that was made by Aaron that was in Egypt that said, these be your gods? The calf. Calf is a very important deity. And so here we have Jeroboam making two calves. He made one and he set it up at Bethel in verse 29, and he put the other one in Dan. This thing became a sin, as you can well imagine. Verse 32, Jeroboam ordained a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did at Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made. And at Bethel, he installed the priests of the high places which he had made. So he made offerings on the altar which he had made at Bethel on the 15th day of the 8th month, in the month which he had devised in his own heart, and he ordained a feast for the children of Israel and offered sacrifices on the altar and burnt incense. So a couple of things have happened in these two chapters. The children of Israel have been divided up into two parts. Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, keeps Judah, Levi, and part of Benjamin. Jeroboam, the servant of Solomon, is given the other 10 tribes, 10 pieces of cloth. Jeroboam, to keep Israel from going back and worshiping in Jerusalem, ordains a false feast. Tied in with all of this is Molech and the gods that are in the form of calves, because this was where Mithra worship was involved. Now, let's look at something else. This is how this all began. Let's go forward about 10 pages to 2 Kings. 2 Kings. We're looking at an example as to what happened to the children of Israel and how it relates to us and this world keeping Christmas. 2 Kings chapter 22. Now, Josiah reigns in Judah. This is several hundred years after Rehoboam and Jeroboam. We have Josiah, who is a descendant of David. We still have Israel, who is separate from them. But Josiah reigns in Judah. Notice verse 22. Josiah was 8 years old when he became king, and he reigned 31 years in Jerusalem. Verse 2. He did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, and walked in all the ways of his father, David. He did not turn aside to the right hand or the left. He was one of the very few righteous kings in Judah. Now, they're taking up money to remodel the temple that has fallen into disrepair. Verse 6 talks about carpenters and builders and masons to repair the house. Verse 8, then the high priest said to the scribe, I have found the book of the law. So the book of the law had been lost, and Josiah finds it when all this remodeling is going on. And in the book of the law is mentioned some of the things that we've been reading, because we've been reading out of the book of law, Deuteronomy and Exodus and various other places. Verse 11, now it happened when the king heard the words of the book of the law, he tore his clothes. He said, if this is true, and there's going to be curses brought on us for these things mentioned in here, we are in trouble, because we're doing all these things that are mentioned in here. Verse 16, thus says the Lord, behold, I will bring calamity on this place and on its inhabitants, all the words of the book which the king of Judah has read, because they, in times past, have forsaken me and burned incense to other gods, that they might provoke me to anger with all the works of their hands. Therefore my wrath shall be aroused against this place and shall not be quenched. Now notice verse chapter 23. Now the king sent them to gather all the elders of Judah and Jerusalem to him. The king went up to the house of the Lord with all the men of Judah and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the priests and the prophets and all the people, both small and great, and he read in their hearings all the books of the covenant of the law, which we've just been reading. That's covered in verse 3. Notice verse 4. Now, I want you to think about something. You got the temple. In the temple, you have the altar of incense, the showbread, the seven-headed candelabra. You have a veil in there, and in the veil you have the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, you can't get any more holy than the Holy of Holies and the holy place and the temple. Notice what had happened, because they had let a little bit of paganism creep in. Verse 4, and the king commanded Hilkiah the high priest, the priest of the second order, and the doorkeepers to bring out of the temple of the Lord all the articles that were made for Baal. They were in the temple. For Asherah, and for all the hosts of heaven. Remember we talked about astrology? All the hosts of heaven. And he burned them outside Jerusalem in the field of Kidron and carried their ashes to Bethel. Then he removed the idolatrous priest whom the kings of Judah before him had ordained to burn incense on the high places in the cities of Judah and the places all around Jerusalem, and those who burned incense to Baal, to the sun, to the moon, to the constellations, and to all the hosts of heaven. And he brought out the wooden image from the house of God to the brick Kidron outside of Jerusalem, and he burned it. So there was this big image that was in the temple itself, and he brought it out and burned it. Verse 7, then he tore down the ritual booths of the perverted persons. Let me rephrase that. Then he tore down the ritual booth of the perverts that were in the house of the Lord, where the women wove hangings, for the wooden image. Let me not be too gross here, but what was a wooden image? A lot of scholars say that the wooden image was a part of the male anatomy that points to heaven. Verse 8, and he brought all the priests from the cities of Judah and defiled the high places where the priests had burnt incense from Geba to Beersheba. He also broke down the high places at the gates, which were at the entrance of the gate of Joshua, the governor of the city, which were to the left of the city gate. Verse 10, he defiled Topheth, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnon. This is later translated as the valley of Gehenna. That no man might make his son or his daughter pass through the fire to Molech. What was happening? There in Jerusalem, outside the city, they were offering up children as sacrifices. Then he removed the horses that the kings of Judah had dedicated to the sun. Why did you need horses? Well, you see, the sun was dragged on this chariot, and the chariot had horses to it. So you had these horses that the gods could use to move the sun up and down the heavens. By the chamber of Nathan-Melech, the officer who was in the court, and he burned the chariots of the sun with fire. The altars that were on the roof, the upper chamber of Ahaz, the kings of Judah, and the altars which Manasseh had made. The king broke them down and pulverized them. Listen to this, verse 13. Then the king defiled the high places that were on the east of Jerusalem, which were on the south of the Mount of Corruption, which Solomon, king of Israel, had built for Astartha, the abomination of the Sidonians, for Chemosh, the abomination of the Moabites, and for Milcom, the abomination of the people of Ammon. You remember back in 1 Kings when we read about Solomon building these things? They were still there. They were still there in the city of Jerusalem. What would you say if I told you 300 years from now there was going to be a big memorial in Washington, D.C. on the mall dedicated to communism?
I believe it.
Probably. We're going that way. But the point is this. You would think it wouldn't happen. Verse 14. And he broke in pieces the sacred pillars. Think about what those could be. And cut down the wooden images and filled their places with the bones of men. Verse 19. Now Josiah also took away all the shrines of the high places that were in the cities of Samaria, which the kings of Israel had made to provoke the Lord to anger. Verse 20. He executed all the priests of the high places who were there on the altars and burned men's bones on them, and he returned to Jerusalem. And then in verse 21, they began to keep the Passover, probably the first Passover that had been kept in several hundred years. Be careful when you wish to live in the time of the kings of Israel and Judah. Because you might statistically be living in a time of abject paganism. Because most of the kings of Israel and most of the kings of Judah, except for a few handful, were all pagans. And they worship the sun god, most of them. They worship the bull. All of these are tied in to some of the holidays we have been reading about. Mark chapter 7. Mark chapter 7. You know, when you think about a holiday or something, we often think about what other people would think. Or what do I think about this idea? Or how do I see this in historical context? Don't do that, brother. The easy way to figure out if something is right or wrong is simple. Think about what would God think about this. What does God think about Christmas? When God sees Christmas, he sees sun worship. He sees calf worship. He sees Molech and children being sacrificed to Molech. That's what he sees. That's the history he sees. You know, you and I, especially if we were not born in the church, oh, we have Christmas and we have trees and we have food and we have all these things. That's not what we should be thinking. We should be thinking, well, how does God see it? What is the history God sees in it? That's what we should be thinking. Mark chapter 7. Verse 6, he answered and said to them, well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites as is written? This people honors me with their lips. Oh, Christmas and Christ, and let's put the Savior back into Christmas and a time of giving and all of this. This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me, and in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. Christmas is a doctrine of men, brethren. It is not something that you will find in the Bible. 2 Corinthians. We got to be very careful at this time of season, this time of the year. Because if you're not careful, pretty soon you're whistling Christmas songs. It's very, and there's Christmas is all around you. It just inundates all of us. And you got to be very careful, get your thoughts in order, and be careful what you do and what you're involved in. 2 Corinthians. Chapter 11, verse 13. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 13. For such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also transfer themselves into ministers of righteousness, whose ends will be according to their works. If you would have asked Aaron, is this calf godly? Oh, yes, it is. Yep. you'd ask the priest of Baal back in the time of Josiah, are you worshiping God? Yes, we are. Mm-hmm. Certainly are. Of course we are. Let me leave you with a final thought, brethren. Let's go to Revelation chapter 18. Christmas, without a doubt, brethren, Christmas, without a doubt, as it has been proven by my children when they were 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, and can be proven by anybody that can read, Christmas, without a doubt, has come to us from paganism. This paganism was centered on and came out of the Babylon mystery religion. We read about that Babylonian system in Daniel chapter 2. Still very much alive and well, because a stone hasn't come out of heaven and hit the feet yet. Although Babylon doesn't exist, the image is still standing. And we're living in a society that worships that image. Babylon is alive and well. What God said to the Apostle John, in the verse we're going to read, is still very applicable for today. Even though Babylon is alive and well, we should do well to heed what it says in Revelation chapter 18, verse 1. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon is still alive, brethren, but not always. Babylon, one day, the great is going to fall, has fallen, and has become the dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. For all nations, the majority of the people keeping Christmas, for all nations and other pagan holidays, for all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues.